It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Domenech. I hope you will rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcasts.com. And today, we have a real treat for you. Honestly, this is the kind of interview I've been looking forward to for months. It's Bill Barr, the former Attorney General of the United States. He obviously had served under multiple presidents in multiple roles. His latest book is One Damn Thing After Another, which I just have to credit whoever told him to title a book like that. It's much more interesting than the kind of bland titles you could have gone with. We talk about a number of different things, including his relationship with Donald Trump, you know, the attitude that he has toward the future of the Republican Party, his choice of whether he is a Reagan or a Nixon man. I was surprised by his answer to that personally. Bill Barr, coming up next.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bill Barr, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. It's a pleasure to have you join us for a conversation.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me.
I rarely get to ask this question of people, so I'll start with this. Do you think of yourself more as a Nixon man or a Reagan man?
Reagan. That was a hard question because I just came back from the Nixon Library and the Reagan Library, and they were both great events.
I'm curious about why that is, but I assumed that you would answer that way, but I'm curious as to your own calculation of why you would make that distinction.
Well, because I think Reagan was more philosophically a conservative, and he also had that populist streak in the sense that he had a tremendous faith in the average American, and that came through. He was able to unite the Republican Party and draw in a lot of what we now call Reagan Democrats, which are, you know, middle class, everyday Americans who, he had special resonance for. And so I think he transformed the Republican Party and changed America.
There is a tendency on the part, I think, of many conservatives today to adopt what could potentially be described as an almost warlike posture against the American left, a left that they truly believe is dedicated to the destruction of what they love about this country, and to perhaps have a more Nixonian attitude toward that effort as opposed to Reagan's happy warrior concept. In terms of understanding that development within the conservative movement, do you believe that there's a place for both, or that there needs to be kind of a return to that Reagan-esque attitude of trying to convince our fellow Americans in a lot of respects?
I think we need to return to the Reagan attitude. By the way, I have a tremendous amount of sympathy and respect for Nixon's position. You know, he felt the wrath of the left. He was sort of the first president to be torn to shreds, and the hatred for him was very intense, going back to his role in the Helger Hiss case. And I can understand the intensity of his feelings against the left. They also tried to take down Reagan, but Reagan's style of dealing with them was much different, much more affable, as you say, a happy warrior style. But he was tough and he was strategic in his thinking. In some ways, you know, in my book, I sort of discuss this, which is a lot of the American people, a lot of conservatives, a lot of the working and middle class were very frustrated and mad at what was happening to the country under the progressive influence during the Obama administration. And in some sense, they wanted to stick their eye, stick their finger in the eye. They wanted to strike back. And Trump caught that feeling of anger. And they liked his punching back all the time and his firmness and his direct speaking and so forth. And that played a positive role in him winning the primary and then ultimately winning the election. But I've said it publicly, I think the Make America Great Again movement has to mature. We actually have to start thinking, what does it take to make America great? And it takes more than somebody just constantly fighting, punching back, punching down, and it takes someone who thinks things through strategically and has a program to put America back on the right course and in cold blood can execute that program and not let these fights, completely overwhelm the positive agenda that we need to execute on. And I think that was Reagan's style. And I think that's what we need going forward.
You know, that maturity concept, something that I have heard you say in other venues, is something that I think is very critical in this moment. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about what that would look like. One of the frustrations that seems to drive so much of the way that younger conservatives in particular think about this is this drive toward, what is referred to online as owning the libs, or dunking on the left to punch down or punch, back in every opportunity, as you said. But that doesn't solve the long-term problems, the very real ones that prevent the application of a conservative agenda, don't they?
No, they don't. And most of what, I think most of Trump's accomplishments, other than his judicial appointments to the Supreme Court, were really blocking bad things from happening, not so much adopting long-term solutions and putting things on a healthier trajectory for the country. And even his judicial appointments are somewhat undercut by the fact that all the appointees of Clinton are now retiring. And if we had held office for another 4 years, we could have replaced all those circuit court judges. But now the liberals are going to dominate in that sphere of the judiciary because we lost the election. So, So I think what it looks like is a number of things. One, Reagan was able to unite the average American, the working class, the rural areas with the college-educated suburban people who were Republican in sympathies, if not outright registered Republican. He brought those groups together. And then he actually attracted a lot of Democrats and classical liberals who were revolted by the excesses of the left during the 60s and 70s. We need a similar kind of candidate today who can bring those forces together. Trump deserves credit for helping solidify the Republican Party as a working class party, but he's done it at the expense of a lot of other constituencies and needlessly, because there's, as Youngkin's victory in Virginia showed and the performance of our candidate in New Jersey showed, they're not mutually exclusive. So one, we need a style that unifies like that. Number two, we can't go back to what people hate about the so-called swamp, which is Republicans who are completely captured by the Washington environment and make decisions based on whether they're going to be praised by the Washington Post and the New York Times. That's one of the things that offended middle America. And we can't go back to that. We have to be willing to fight. And I believe that people, there's some truth when people say, Trump taught Republicans how to fight, and we do need to fight. I also think we need to be strategic. We have to come into power next time with a strong majority, win a decisive victory like Reagan did in 80, where he won 40 states and then won re-election by 49 states, and then Bush won 40 states. We need that kind of dominance, and we need a program that essentially goes back to basics, that has, that our goal is to restore the basic structure of American government, how it's supposed to operate, the federal system, smaller government with less ambition, maximize personal freedom. And we need a program of how we're going to get there, how we're going to downsize the bureaucracy, reduce the areas the federal government is in, and so forth, and start executing on that program. And, you know, I don't think chaos, Trump disrupted the progressive juggernaut, but now we need something different. Mm-hmm.
There's a natural tendency, I think, among a lot of conservatives across the country who've lived through the last decade or plus of feeling that they are up against a hopeless situation with the behemoth that represents the federal bureaucracy, and that the combination of the administrative state and the quote-unquote deep state, or the law enforcement power that is weaponized against them, is something that can't be overcome. And that leads you to this mentality of this kind of Hail Mary approach, this desperation move to try to wreck the system. How do you go about achieving those ends realistically of a more humble bureaucracy, one that actually doesn't occupy this eternal status in Washington program history, and a law enforcement arm that isn't so easily weaponized by partisan forces, and deliver on that to a conservative movement and to a broader Republican coalition that seems to very much be wanting that, but don't really know how to get it?
Well, I think it takes time, and it's not something that can be accomplished. It was not something that Trump would have been able to accomplish, even if he had a coherent program of doing it. It was too short a period of time. I think you need at least two, but probably three terms in office to make, you know, to make serious progress in that. Part of, and you need to control Congress, because part of what has to happen is our laws and budget discipline and changes to the civil service laws that give the president more discretion over incumbents deeper down in the bureaucracy, terminating some agencies altogether, moving other agencies out of Washington, D.C., a whole set of things that could be done. But also there's a self-correction involved. When I took over the department under H.W. Bush, it was after 8 years of Reagan. And the place was a centrist organization. It was not what people would refer to as a deep state organization. And part of that was 8 years of Ronald Reagan. When I took it over after 8 years of Obama, it was a much different place. And I think had Trump won re-election, a lot of people would have left government because they would have been frustrated at having to live under another term of Trump. That is, let the progressive activist types that burrow into the government. So mm-hmm. There's a sort of a self-correction, and I feel, another thing, is defund the left. That was a big thing under Reagan. And we have to get back to that. I mean, a lot of the public money is being spent actually on left wing organizations. But there are agendas across the board, deep agendas that have to be followed, to get our military back into a fighting organization instead of a social experiment. Mm-hmm. And other things that we have to do. And the first step is to win a broad victory. And a broad and deep election victory with a candidate who understands these things and has the discipline to carry through on them.
Mm-hmm. The issue of election fraud is obviously one that is animating a significant portion of people within the Republican coalition right now. They're very focused on it. They care a great deal about it. Whatever their beliefs about the 2020 election in terms of whether it would have changed the outcome or not, they feel frustrated that fraud is present and not being fully investigated or is being kind of swept aside. What's the right note to strike when talking about election fraud that recognizes its reality in certain respects, but also doesn't go too far in terms of undermining Americans' faith in their own form of government and representative elections in a way that is damaging to the project of a representative republic?
Well, first is to understand exactly the different phenomenon we're talking about. First, I said from my very first days in office that I was very worried about the integrity of elections, and most importantly, whether the Americans accept the integrity of elections, have confidence in them. And I think everything has to, because we are so divided and the stakes are so high, the gulf between the parties is so great ideologically that we have to make sure that the elections are fair. And that work has to be done before an election, because it gets very hard after election to unscramble the egg. And therefore we have to fight tooth and nail, as some of the governors have, to make sure that the rules mandate integrity in the election process. There are three different phenomena at play. One are things that are not illegal on their face, but which skew the playing field. So, putting out places to collect ballots, changing the time limit in which people have to vote and so forth. Permitting harvesting and things like that. Those are not, illegal for the state to do, but they skew the playing field. And there was a lot of that being done in the name of COVID. And some of it was done maybe where it actually should have required legislative approval and was done by lesser officials. And that then raises the question whether those rules were proper under state law. The second set of things is rules to protect against fraud, such as prohibitions on harvesting or requirements of having Republican or both parties having observers in the poll, or requiring an application that be filed and verified in order to get an absentee ballot. Those are examples of those kinds of rules. And there are cases where those rules are violated. Now, what a lot of people don't understand is that when those rules are violated, that's bad, and those people should go to jail, so if you're violating the harvesting laws and so forth. But it doesn't mean you throw out the votes. Mm-hmm. That's not the remedy. You still, in order to throw out a vote, you still have to show it's an illegal vote. So when a harvester goes out and brings in some ballots, you don't just throw out all the ballots, even if you could figure out what they were. That's one of the other problems you have, is after the election, you really can't figure out where those ballots came from. But but you still have to show, in order to affect the count, you still have to show that the vote was unlawful in the sense it was not a legitimate voter. So the remedy, for example, if they chase a Republican out of a polling station, is not to throw out all the votes from that polling station. You still have to show. So that makes it very hard to do. And it also means that, whining about that stuff after the fact doesn't mean you change the election outcome. The third set of things are what falls under the heading of fraud. And fraud occurs when, there's cheating in the sense that people who are not allowed to vote, or phantom voters, their votes are included. And people who were valid voters, their votes are excluded in some way. That's fraud. And starting at the day of the night of the election, or the early morning when the president came down and started talking. He started talking about fraud, major fraud underway. And he's been talking about fraud. And a lot of the initial allegations when I was in office were about fraud, you know, about the machines, about, you know, a truckload of bogus documents being dropped, about suitcases of bogus. That was all nonsense. There was not fraud in that sense on the scale that would have affected the election. And so those are the different pots. Now, the one, we have to recognize that we have, as a party, we have to do everything we can to prevent gaming the system, including this Zuckerberg money stuff, which may or may not be illegal. I don't know enough about it, but you know, but we have to do everything we can. Number two, that has to be done before the election. And number three, after election, it's good to have a robust retrospective examination of things because it helps keep people honest. I'm all for that. But to start going out and saying that the election was stolen, I thought was irresponsible because there was not evidence to show that the election was stolen. And there are two things that I think people have to, again, grow up about. Number one is the Trump campaign knew there was a risk and they didn't prepare effectively. And one of the reasons they didn't prepare effectively is because they didn't have the money. They ran out of money, and they ran out of money because it was a trough where people were feeding at. And so, although in the spring of 2020, a lot of lawyers were telling the president and the campaign that they had to, you know, proactively go out and get involved in some of this stuff with more aggressive legal effort, they didn't do it. And he was warned about this, and people and law firms were, you know, saying, you know, we really need to get in there and deal with it. And he wouldn't do it. He was convinced that he needed 65 million votes to win, and he was going to get that from his base. He did get 75 from his base, but he lost the election. That's number one. And number two is, when you really look at the election results, the idea that it was stolen from him is just bogus. He ran weaker than the Republican ticket in the battleground states. Okay, so then in Pennsylvania, he lost 50 to 60,000 Republican votes that, that voted straight Republican, but didn't vote for him. And just to compare that to Ronald Reagan, when he ran for re-election, he not only won every Republican, I mean, he ran better than the Republican ticket by 470,000 votes. That means 470,000, half a million Democrats in Pennsylvania voted for him and then voted the rest Democrat. That's a transformative figure. That's a populist. Trump was the weaker candidate on the Republican ticket in the battleground states. You're not going to win a close race that way. So the idea this was stolen from him and that he really won by a landslide is just poppycock.
So I don't mean to diminish the importance of presidential elections by comparing them to sports, but I think of the 2020 election in much the same way that I think of the 2002 Western Conference Finals between the LA Lakers and the Sacramento Kings, which are, you know, broadly considered one of the greatest contests in the NBA playoffs in the past couple of decades. It was years later that we found out that one of the referees in it, Tim Donaghy, had essentially admitted to fixing game six with the ways that fouls were called. But you don't go back and get to play the game again. So even if there are things that went on that were untoward, and I think that many people believe, and I think there's strong proof that there were things that were untoward that were happening, the key thing that you say there to me is, once these things go in, it's almost impossible to get them out or to track them. And so the mistakes were being made beforehand that led to this circumstance. One thing I am curious about, though, is how do we prevent that the next time around? How can we get through? We've had back-to-back elections where with a losing side did not believe that they lost honestly, you know, in 2016 and 2020. And whether you, you know, ascribe that to foreign interference, as Hillary Clinton did, whether you ascribe that to massive fraud, as former President Trump does, you know, it is a good thing in America to have the losing side believe that they lost honestly. And if they don't, that becomes a problem for the system.
Right. Right.
So how is that prevented?
Well, I just want to reiterate, I mean, stress that, which is there are two different issues. One issue is whether or not there's fraud. If you diminish the protections, people are not going to have confidence in the outcome, whether you can prove fraud or not. Whether there was fraud or not is a different issue, and we can discuss that also. But we cannot, we shouldn't, as I kept on saying before the election, we shouldn't be diminishing the protections. We should be increasing the protections. And that's the only thing we can do. And we have to be very vigilant in, especially in the swing states, the states that are going to make a difference. That's, you know, and make it much harder to game the system.
The thing that I think is so interesting about you, and there are many interesting things about you, but you actually told the president you thought he was going to lose.
Right.
Do you think that you're the only cabinet member who did that?
No, I know for a fact I'm not. Okay. I think, you know, the cabinet secretaries, I think, that were most attuned to politics all felt, you know, all had varying degrees of concern in this area. I think I know of at least one other who went in around the same time I went in. And I think a number of his White House advisors felt the same way, and some of his political advisors. It was quite clear. The polling data was quite clear. You know, his base was very strong behind him. Rural America was strong behind him. But there was a critical group in the suburbs, college educated, predominantly more women than men, but still both, who were either independents who leaned Republican or Republicans who had were disgusted by his behavior and his persona. And they defected, and they and we lost them in 2000. Some of them in 2016, and then they defected in the 18 election, and they were polling negative in 20. Mm-hmm. And anyone who lives in a state who's you know even vaguely aware of political circumstances, like in Virginia or Pennsylvania or any of or Georgia, knows what we're talking about. The Republicans are actually fairly close in Virginia to the Democrats. It's not that far gone as a Republican state. And yet about 10% of the Republican vote in the suburbs abandoned the Republican Party under Trump. And then they came back to Youngkin and we won.
One thing that really is present of mind for me about the playing out things differently in retrospect, separate from the election related issues, is the response that the administration had to the summer of Floyd. If you could replay that summer, what do you think should have been done differently, if anything, to try to confront the riotousness and violence that happened relative to acts of protest where local officials, particularly in blue cities, were basically saying, don't come here, don't send more cops, don't send in the National Guard, you know, don't do anything to prevent this. Even as a lot of suburbanites looked upon the scenes in front of them with horror, and frankly, obviously resulted in now trackable losses of population for a lot of these cities and the like.
Well, it's hard to look at the summer without also thinking about COVID. I think COVID was more of a factor than, frankly, the rioting was. I think the rioting actually ended up helping the Republican Party. Mm. And I think a lot of voters who were inclined to be Republican but really didn't like Trump and would have preferred to vote against Trump at the end of the day held their nose and said, you know, I'd rather have Trump and some law and order than the opposite. Mm-hmm. So I actually think that one of the reasons he got 75 million votes instead of 65 million votes was because of the rioting and the idea that the Democrats were going back to the Ferguson stuff and the rising crime. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think, you know, I wouldn't, we tried our best to, the federal government doesn't have the ability without using the regular military to directly intervene and control rioting outside a very limited number of cities. You know, we could go into LA, as we did in 1992. But if there are riots in three, four, five cities, significant ones, the federal government does not have the ability to deal with it directly. We have to work through the states. We don't have, you know, thousands of U.S. marshals we can just send. So, and most of the federal resources from both DHS and Justice Department are not suited for that kind of thing. You know, SWAT teams have long rifles. You know, they're not designed to deal with rioters.
It sounds like there's very little that you think could have been done differently. In those circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically we had to hold the feet to the fire. We had to hold the locals' feet to the fire. Mm-hmm. And not let them off the hook, and say, look, it's your job to do it. You should call out the National Guard if you need it. We're there to help you. We will stiffen, you know, we'll send, you know, some tactical units to help. We will go after the arsonists. We will go after, you know, the people who've traveled through out of state and so forth. But not in, you know, securing the streets, that has to be done by the state and local. And we couldn't. You know, sort of preempt and jump in and say, okay, we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. I guarantee you that if we had jumped into, you know, the president, you know, wanted to send the paratroopers into Portland. And if you actually start thinking that through, you know, what would their mission be? What would they do? But the problem is that would metastasize, the rioting would have resurged. It had basically died out in the country. It would have come back, and then the governors would have said, you broke it, you fix it.
Yeah.
And that would have been, you know, 3 months before the election. And, you know, we would have had rioting across the country. It would have been a terrible position for the administration to be in.
The current Attorney General, Merrick Garland, was put forward as being someone who was a return to normalcy by the media, someone who would be a consensus choice for the position. In his early tenure, he has gotten embroiled in this whole thing related to the consideration of parents frustrated at local school boards for a host of different issues as domestic terrorists, categorizing them potentially as threats in response to request from school board related organizations. This act is something where I hear this a lot across the country, is they contrast the violence of the summer of Floyd with the actions of these parents, which obviously, with I think maybe one exception, you know, have not involved violence at all. What did you think about that storyline and the way that this DOJ seems to be once again weaponized against a category of people who are politically inconvenient?
I think my view is that the Department of Justice, when I was there, and I have no reason to believe it was different, you know, under Sessions. You know, the president had a certain narrow set of interests, which he tweeted about and which he was constantly talking about. And justifiably upset by Russiagate, but, you know, he was, you know, saying that he wanted scalps essentially for the people involved. Other than those public outbursts by him, the fact of the matter is during the administration, the Department of Justice was not under pressure from the White House to do anything. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that, you know, we're sitting over there and the White House is calling the shots and Bill Barr's a toady who's doing whatever the president wants was, of course, preposterous. But that was the narrative. That was the narrative. And you know, it was complete nonsense. But the media always says that about Republican AGs. And the fact of the matter is that the White House's and Democratic administrations are far more intrusive and put far more pressure on justice than the Republican administrations do. That's a fact. And I think they probably have tried to put pressure on Merrick Garland on a range of things. And, hope and wish him well and you know, running the department professionally. But the media narrative about the department has always been garbage. You know, when I come in, you know, they go and they interview the political, the left-wing political activist types who are in the department, and there are a number of them, and they interview them, and then they write articles sort of saying, you know, the career people are terrible. And I could say, oh, really? We'll go and interview some of the career prosecutors who really care about, you know, the drug war and going after gangs and stuff like that. And see how they feel now and see how they felt about Bill Barr and then see how they feel about now. But, you know, the single most important factor in our politics today is the corruption of the media. Mm-hmm. And when you talked earlier about the disappointment or the frustration of the conservatives these days, I wouldn't be worried about the government and the deep state. What I think the main source of the problem is the one party system we have in our media, in our mainstream mm-hmm. media, with the exception of Fox and a few others.
Mm-hmm. There's something about that seems to have changed. And I wonder if you agree with this analysis. It seems to me that when I was younger, the focus was on media bias and the idea that, you know, these entities are biased in one direction. You know, they carry water. They, defend these leftist things. Now it almost seems like the media drives the left agenda to a much greater degree than the actual elected officials themselves, that it's that they almost work, you know, not in a way where they take their notes from the politicians, but the politicians take their notes from the media and take their guidance from it. Do you think that that's something that has shifted in your time serving?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, the media has been biased, and part of, you know, in my book, I discuss how they brought down H.W. Bush.
Yes.
Trump was not the first president to be taken to, you know, where the media went for the jugular. They did with H.W. But by and large, in those days, you know, the media were sort of.
Can I just interject? I still the grocery scanner thing is still one of my most favorite examples of yeah. just an invented and a completely false invented story that went everywhere that still, you know, has some familiarity anyway.
And so they were basically, you know, they were basically journalists who also were partisan Democrats, and they knew what they were doing. And when they sort of tilted in favor of the Democrats and did stuff in favor of the Democrats. Nowadays, I think the journalists are, they view themselves as agents of social change. They're more than just sort of partisan in the sense like, oh yeah, I'm a Democrat. They are leading the charge. They view themselves as sort of the part of the vanguard of the progressive revolution, and they're not interested in the facts. They're interested in the narrative. And I mean, part of the other things I discuss in my book is the way, as we moved away from an idea of objective truth and moved more to the concept of a narrative, where sort of everyone's, you know, there is no objective truth. There's just how people perceive it. And my narrative is as good as your narrative. And I'm going to tell my narrative because it suits my purpose. You know, so.
It is. It's not just that they believe that history has an arc. They want to chart that arc themselves.
Right.
And they want the politicians to follow through on it. And they're going to hammer away at them until they do.
Right.
And the thing that, it's so interesting to look back at how much our politics has changed. One of the debates that broke out on Twitter, in fact, just the other day, inspired by Elon Musk, he posted an image, which has been around for a while, of where it's a couple of stick figures. And the one on the right is basically staying in the same position. The one on the left is pushing further and further left. And the person who starts in the center ends up on the right, you know, by the end of the graphic. And it sparked a debate about people saying, oh, well, you know, this is leaving out the rights become a lot more extreme. I think, as you would bear witness, the right has actually become, if anything, far more moderate than it was on a host of issues, both social and economic, in the last couple of decades, as it becomes more of a party of the working class in a lot of different respects. I wonder, how can you kind of create a new fusionism that achieves that Reagan approach that you're talking about in an era where everything around us, our media, our social media, these different frames and silos of truth that exist, are meant to further those divisions?
It's certainly harder to do, but I guess, what I say to my friends is, look, don't despair, okay? Mm-hmm. Because things always look this way when you're not in power, mm-hmm. in the sense that nothing changes circumstances as much as a big presidential victory. Mm-hmm. A change in administration that also gains control of Congress. The world looks a lot different at that point. And that, to me, is the essential first step in sort of, being able to sustain sort of, a fusion in the different elements that are potentially allies to the conservative approach to things. Right now, it looks very difficult. But you said something leading into this. I can't remember exactly what it was, but
just that it seems to me like this is something that that has to be a priority in order to achieve that kind of Reagan-esque sweeping victory. But there seems to be a lot of barriers to it, and I wonder. I mean, perhaps let's think about this for a moment. There's obviously, you're someone who is associated with, the whole process of choosing, you know, a sweeping number of judicial nominees and people who have obviously, you know, come into the judiciary and already have an enormous impact. We see, you know, a judge in Florida who allowed me to take my mask off on an airplane the other day, much to my enjoyment. And I see, you know, within that project, you know, a sustained effort to push through an institution that some had given up as lost, and retake it for people who would have the right ordered approach to governance. That project is one that took a long time. And has not been without, you know, critics both within the right and people who are skeptical of it. And yet now we are, you know, in my lifetime, I never thought I would see the possibility of a potential return of the issue of abortion to the voters of the states. And yet that seems something that now is realistically talked about. What can we do to take lessons from that?
Yeah. Thank you for teeing that up, because that's essentially what I was trying to get at earlier when I was talking about these things take time, and they take a strategic outlook and a step-by-step of executing on a step-by-step program. So, for example, federalism and a return to a much more aggressive federalist system, a much more federal system, to me is essential for the survival of our country, because we are a pluralistic society, much more so than we were in 1960. The only safety valve for that, and the thing that ultimately will help keep us together and diffuse some of the passions in the system, is to decentralize it. And, you know, federalism was meant to be a release valve. And instead, as we've tried to manage the country as a consolidated 350 million person republic, it's become a pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. And so we need a step-by-step return to the idea of subsidiarity, where decisions are made at the lowest level possible. And that takes people willing to tolerate differences elsewhere in the country, mm-hmm. and not insist that, you know, just because I view it this way, the whole country has to agree with me. And, you know, the whole liberal sentiment is that, you know, abortion has to be, you know, easily available everywhere in the country. And if any woman in the country has at least been inhibited from it, you know, it's a crisis. And, you know, we're not going to be able to function as a unitary republic with such a diverse and, you know, pluralistic society. So it's like, as you say, it's putting in place the processes that will allow our country to survive with different viewpoints and return to the kinds of politics we had historically. Another area is diversification of media. You know, we're not going to be able to deal with censorship by, you know, setting up government boards and having, you know, some kind of discussion of what's disinformation and what's not disinformation. The only solution is more speech. You know, the only solution is a multiplicity of voices. And therefore, we have to adopt regulatory policies, not that regulate the speech, but that promote and permit multiple voices. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have to do that on the internet, and we have to do that, you know, with networks and other things like that. So a whole series of areas that have to be adjusted to provide for the kind of political life that we used to have. And, you know, clearly, as I say in the book, and, you know, there's hard data, empirical data showing that what's happened in our country since 1960 is the sharp move of the Democrats to the left. And the Republicans have basically stayed put.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go out on this, just a personal question. Many people obviously are aware of how much the presidency ages someone. There's all those pictures of, you know, the youthful Obama coming in and then the graying Obama leaving. Yeah. That's a role that obviously you carry the weight of the country and the world on your shoulders. Less attention is paid to how much service in government can contribute to the same thing. So my question for you is, how have you gone about living a less stressful life since leaving the experience of being Attorney General under President Trump?
So, you know, unfortunately, I sort of made the decision after I left that I would write a book. And, you know, that was a hard task. You know, I found it harder than I thought. I wasn't used to that kind of writing. And so I was sort of absorbed by that. And then I've been doing the book promotion stuff. And I'm looking forward to next month when that sort of tapers off and I'll be able to essentially go into a period of rest, R&R. And so the answer to your question is I haven't really had the opportunity to do that. I haven't been able to lose the weight I always promised myself. I put on 20 pounds, which I could ill afford.
A lot of us are with you in that during the COVID period, I will admit.
Yeah. And I deferred a lot of the stuff I should be doing for health things. And so I plan to live a more balanced life going forward. But the stress, the concentrated stress does certainly take its toll.
Would you ever serve in a similar capacity again, do you think?
I doubt I'd ever go back to justice simply because it's like walking across a minefield. I mean, it's probably the most hazardous duty you can go, because there's always people inside and outside that are sniping at you and trying to, you know, trying to get you. And I'm not sure I'd want to walk through that minefield again. But I would never say I would never serve in public service again. I would probably only do it for a president that I was personally close to and knew and had respect for.
Mm-hmm. Well, I still have hopes that that is possible, both for the sake of you and for the country. thank you, General Parr. Much appreciated.
Right. Okay, great. Thanks. Bye.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this. So I am interested in what's going to come out of the next month for a number of reasons. As I think you probably are all aware, May is going to be a month of primaries on the Republican side. Primaries that are going to include a bunch of competitive races in states across the country. And ones where former President Donald Trump has weighed in a significant way on behalf of a particular candidate. He is endorsed in a number of different races. As Politico writes, in a four-week stretch of primaries running from Nebraska and West Virginia to Idaho, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, Trump-endorsed candidates are slogging through difficult races where the former president's blessing hasn't proved to be the rocket fuel some expected. In a few cases, his preferred candidates are running far behind. Obviously, that would include Georgia, where he has targeted Governor Brian Kemp with former Senator David Perdue, trying to, you know, unseat him based on essentially allegations about the 2020 election. In Arizona, you have a situation where businessman Jim LeMond seems to be pulling up close to Attorney General Mark Brnovich. Both of them are people who have not been endorsed by Donald Trump and have as a third kind of seed there Blake Masters, the Peter Thiel-backed candidate who Trump may end up endorsing. We'll see. He endorsed the Peter Thiel-backed candidate in Ohio, J.D. Vance, who is locked in a pretty close battle with others in the race. It looks like Josh Mandel, who's been favored by the Club for Growth and by Ted Cruz, has been slipping behind. But it does seem like a situation where, you know, Vance and businessman Dolan has been pretty close together. You know, this is a situation where you may end up with a slew of candidates who win, have either been not endorsed by Trump or are not close to him. What does this mean? From my perspective, it doesn't mean a lot, because Trump will obviously go out on stage and say the fault lies with the candidates, not with himself. But it does say something about his potential power going into the 2024 elections. And if Donald Trump turns out to be somebody who can't really carry people over the finish line, whether, you know, it's within competitive primaries in Ohio, the Pennsylvania Senate race, the Nebraska governor race, you know, all of these different things, maybe it's a situation where his endorsement is something that's beneficial, but it's not more beneficial than others. What do we take away from that? From my perspective, it means that Donald Trump is not as powerful as he maybe thinks he is. But it could also be something that has takeaways for those who might run against him in 2024. If Donald Trump announces for the presidency, which I think we all should assume he will certainly run into challenges. There will be people who run against him. But if those people are people who just represent, you know, essentially factions of the New York Times, like Liz Cheney or Adam Kinzinger, or factions of, let's say, you know, moderate Republicans like Larry Hogan or Governor Sununu from New Hampshire, those people are probably not going to achieve anything. They'll be you know, fodder for consultants who will run ads based on them and, you know, across the country, make money from it, et cetera. The real question is, will Ron DeSantis challenge Donald Trump? And I think that we could find out a lot about the likelihood of that in the coming weeks. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to the Ben Domenech podcast on Fox News. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.